Scriptures that I want to read in James. We're going to be in the book of James in the first chapter, and we're just going to read a couple of verses to get our thought this morning. So the epistle of James in the first chapter and starting in the 26th verse. James writes, "If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world." And we'll go ahead and finish our reading there. I want us to look, we're going to talk about both of these verses, but I want to look particularly at the 27th verse. "Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world." Now, I have quoted that scripture probably many times and thought on it a lot, but I don't know that I ever was sufficiently able to explain it in my own mind and understand it. And I'm still not 100% sure that I fully grasp all of what James is trying to tell us here, but we're going to try to look at this a little bit. What is James trying to tell us, and how does it apply to our lives and our religion today, if you will? So first of all, just by way of a little bit of background, so James, the writer here, is most likely James, the half-brother of Jesus. Now, there's been some scholarly dispute down through the ages as to whether that this James was James, the Lord's brother, or not. And really, when you get down to it, most of that doing backflips and everything to try to make this James to be someone else comes down to the teaching for centuries in the Catholic Church about the perpetual virginity of Mary. They have taught for centuries that Jesus was born by immaculate conception and that Mary had no other children, and so therefore it would be impossible for Jesus to have an actual half-brother, and so they're, you know, the ones that are called his brothers were really his cousins, and you know, all this, and so all that's lent itself down through the ages to different speculations about who this James was. But the scriptures tell us in Acts that the leaders in the church at Jerusalem during the time of Paul in that first generation church, the leaders in Jerusalem were Peter and John and James, the Lord's brother. That's who Paul says that he talked to when he went to Jerusalem, and he names him as James, the Lord's brother. And so there's no reason, I don't think, to suspect that he was anything other than that one of the half-brothers of Jesus. And that James seems to be a leader in the church in Jerusalem. And it's most likely that that is the same James that writes the epistle here. And most likely, this epistle was probably the first one written. And there's scholarly, you know, reasons to think that. There's really no overtone here of some of the conflict between Gentiles and Jews that we see later on. There's no mention really of some of the things that that Paul had to mention about you know, questions over circumcision and whether or not we should be following the law and to what extent that should apply to the Gentiles. So for that reason, scholars tend to think that this letter was written very early. I don't have any reason to disagree with that. It does seem that he is writing primarily to a Jewish Christian audience, but that he is dealing with a much different issue overall than Paul was dealing with. And that's why, if you're familiar with the book of James at all, you know that that there is perhaps on the surface some conflict between what James is talking about and what Paul's talking about. Now, I say on the surface because there is no conflict. They're talking about the same thing. Paul preached works without faith, and I don't believe that James believed in salvation any other way. But James does, and it's not in our text, but I'll allude to it because I know that you all are familiar with the second chapter of James, where he talks at length about faith without works and sums it up and says faith without works is dead. Well, the reason is that James was dealing with a different problem. Paul was dealing with a problem of Jews that were trying to tell Gentiles that there was some work they had to do. They had to follow the law. They had to get circumcised. They had to do all these things in order to truly be saved. And Paul was trying to emphasize, no, salvation is by faith through grace, or by grace through faith, and not of any works of the law. James was dealing with a different problem. He was dealing with the problem of Jews who were claiming to be followers of Christ and claiming salvation by faith in the in Christ and Him, His being the Messiah, but yet their lives had no indication that they hadn't changed at all. They were still the same old Jews that they had always been in their life, and they had not taken on any of the love, any of the other teachings of Jesus Christ, had not internalized them and began to live them, and they were saying, basically, because I believe Jesus is the Messiah, I'm okay. So he was dealing with a different issue. So not teaching or preaching a different type of salvation, but dealing with a different error than Paul was dealing with. So his emphasis needed to be in a different place. And it's really that kind of backdrop of Jewish Christians that were claiming to be followers of Christ, claiming to believe that that Jesus was the Messiah, but yet their lives were not matching up to that. That is really the underlying issue that James is dealing with throughout this epistle. And so his is a very, I believe, practical epistle because he is talking at length about what the life of a Christian should actually look like on the outside. He wasn't disputing, and this is where we get down to some of perhaps misunderstanding or misuse, I would say misuse of this scripture that we're looking at, the 27th, about pure religion and undefiled. James is not making a sweeping declaration about the complete and total definition of what pure religion is. He is not trying to define it solely as this, but he is confining really what he's talking about to the outward show of religion. He's not dealing at all with the inward part of religion, and I'm using religion in a broad sense. Devotion to God is really what we're talking about. So James is not speaking anything about the inner part, and there is an absolute inner part to devotion to God, to being a child of God, to any form of religion. There is an inner part, but there is also an outer part. There is that part that takes place within ourselves, but then there is that part that that the world sees by our actions. And James is dealing right here with the outward part. And when he goes later here into the second chapter, that's what he's dealing with, is the outward part. He's not talking about the inward part. Now, we know that there must be an inward part, and it is the inward part that saves. That's where we're talking about faith, grace by faith unto salvation. That happens in a man's heart. It's between him and God. I can't see it. You can't see it. James couldn't see it. Nobody else can see it. If a man says, this happened in my heart, well, I don't know, do I? But James is is really picking up right along the lines of what Jesus talked about, is the fruits. There will be fruits that come out. If you have your faith and your religion on the inward part lined up with God the way that it's supposed to be, then there will be certain things that happen on the outside, and that's what I can see and you can see, James can see, and the rest of the world can see. And so he was talking here about the outward aspect of religion. He's not making a declaration of how one gets saved. The supposition is that you're already saved. Remember, he's talking primarily to people, the Jews, that knew the law, and that they had made a declaration that they were followers of Christ. And so he's not talking about the inward part. But this has been misapplied by a lot of people down through the ages. Say, well, you know, if you do that, if you just do what he says is pure religion, you know, visit the widows and orphans and keep yourself unspotted from the world, that's all it really takes to get into heaven. That's not what James was saying. He wasn't talking anything about salvation, which is part of the inward part of religion. So I want us to understand there is an inward part to religion, to a relationship with God, but there is an outward part as well. Now remember, the Jews and the Jewish religion is really, and that's, let me go back for a second and define religion. Religion, the Greek word here that is translated religion, really has reference to outward acts. So when he's talking about religion, that's specifically what he's talking about, is outward acts, those things that can be seen by others. The Greek doesn't have any, the word doesn't have any reference to the inward part. Now, when we use religion, we're talking a lot about the inward part as well. And I heard, you know, that song, Give Me That Old Time Religion, and it's good enough, and we all like that. I heard Brother H.C. Vanderpool one time say he hated that song, and you think, well, how could anybody hate that song? Well, his point was that religion never saved anybody. He was making the distinction of what the word really means, which is the outward acts. He said none of that saved anybody. Religion doesn't save anybody. Jesus saves people, and so we want to make that distinction. What James is talking about is religion in the true sense of the word, of the outward acts here. So let's not get that confused with the need for repentance and faith. And so if you've never had your heart change, none of this is going to matter, because what James is going to be getting to is things that flow out of a changed heart. That's what he's trying to tell these Jewish people. Now, they had already been raised with the law. They knew. He wasn't telling them anything that, like, some shocking news that you ought to be benevolent to widows and orphans. That was enshrined in the law of Moses. It was right there in black and white. He wasn't telling them something new, like, oh, I never heard of that, James. Well, let me go out and do that. He was picking up on something that the law already told them to do, but what he was trying to show is that really you can only do it if it flows out of a changed heart. So, again, the presupposition before we ever even get to this is that there has been a heart change. And then this is a good indicator of whether that heart has really been changed. And so, again, he's not giving a complete definition of what religion is or what service to God is or what a relationship to God is. He's talking about what the outward manifestation of it specifically. And again, he's addressing specifically those errors that early Jews were dealing with, in that they were claiming Christ and the salvation through the Messiah without any real evidence of an outward change in their life. And that's for some of them, and that's what James is addressing here. So, the real question that we're getting at, and the real question that James is bringing to light and trying to answer is, what kind of life does the religion of Jesus Christ produce? If you say that you are a child of God, if you say that you are that you've been saved, that Jesus Christ is your Lord, well, what kind of life does that produce? And that's what James is trying to deal with here, and I think it's a question that we need to deal with. What kind of life does the religion of Jesus Christ, does being saved, produce? If you're truly saved, what kind of outward life does that produce? And that's what James is talking about here. So then I want us to look at another aspect of this. Is I said that religion, as it's used in the Greek, is really talking about these outward acts. I saw some commentators that really think that a better translation, not necessarily a word for word, but a better translation might be worship. Because we do things. Worship is an outward thing that we do. And so perhaps a better way of looking at that is James is talking about what should our worship look like. Now, I'm using worship in the broad sense of the word. Now, when we think of worship, we think of coming to church. We're worshiping this morning, and that's true. But that's not the extent of the meaning of that word. When we think of worship, we think, well, that you're worshiping God when you come to church, and you sit, and you sing, and you listen to preaching. You do all the things that we do in church. That is an aspect of worshiping the Lord, but it's not the complete aspect. And I would say that it is not the greater portion of the aspect. Let's look at how that word is used in the Bible. Let the Bible define what worship means. And I like the picture that we get from Abraham. You know, you all remember Abraham, how that God told him to take his son, his only son Isaac, and to sacrifice him. And Abraham got up and he, in the morning, early in the morning it says, and he got Isaac and he got a couple of his servants, and they saddled the ass, and they went on a 3-day journey out to Mount Moriah. And they got to the foot of that mountain, and he unsaddled the wood and the other things, and what did he tell his servants? He said, "Wait here, the lad and I will go up to worship." Now, what was he getting ready to do? He was getting ready to make a sacrifice. Matter of fact, he was getting ready to sacrifice the thing that he loved the most precious thing to him. He was getting ready to sacrifice before the Lord, and he said that it was worship. Worship is sacrifice. It is giving something unto the Lord. Now, God did not require Abraham to sacrifice his son, did he? That ram was caught in the thicket, and there was a picture of a whole lot of things going on there. And we don't have time to get into that's a sermon or two for another occasion. But you know what he did give to the Lord? He gave obedience, didn't he? And that's what God really wanted, was obedience. Abraham proved that he was willing to be obedient. But what I want you to get to is that all the way back in the time of Abraham, worship was associated with sacrifice. Matter of fact, there was no worship outside of sacrifice. When the Jews came to worship God, they didn't just come in and sit down and sing some songs and read from the law of Moses and you know, then get up and leave. They came and brought sacrifices, didn't they? They brought offering, they brought tithes, and then they brought love offerings, and they brought the first fruits, and they brought the drink offerings and the meal offerings and all that stuff. They gave of what they had unto the Lord. They made sacrifices before the Lord. That was their offering. That was their worship. And so worship before the Lord has more... Now, we sacrifice our time. It's true. When we come in here, we could all be doing something different this morning than being in here. And so there is an element of sacrifice when we come into the church building. But I want you to see that worship, in its truest and fullest sense, has more to it than that. What I want you to see is that we can and should worship God every day outside of this building. And that it is worship when we live for God the way that we should live for God. When our life produces what it should produce, according to James, it is religion. It is outward acts of worship. So let us think about how that the what kind of worship should should being saved produce in somebody. That is what we're getting to. And so, in essence, we could, and this is what helped me really put this into, as I read some commentators and got into the words, and really the Lord helped me so I could put this verse into better perspective. Because again, pure religion and undefiled before God the Father is this. Let's reword that just a little bit. I don't want to take liberties with translating, but I've given you all this background, and so I'm going to suggest a different way to state this. That I think maybe will make a little bit more sense to us. That practical worship and undefiled before God is this. Practical worship. That's the title of my sermon. I went a long way around to get you to the point that I want you to center on. Practical worship. Now, practical means has a use. Now, a use to the world outside of ourselves. You know, we talk about there's the heart side of Christianity, and we focus a lot on that, and we should, about faith and prayer life and all those things. But listen, those happen internally, and that is a huge aspect of serving God, but there is a practical side. I want you to look at the life of Jesus if you don't believe me. What did he do? Yes, we know that he sometimes he prayed all night. He had an internal part, didn't he? He had a part where he communed with the Father. He'd go off by himself and commune with the Father. That's the internal part of serving God. But the majority of what we read about in the New Testament is what? Is the practical worship of Jesus Christ. And yes, he worshiped the Father, didn't he? Because he sacrificed. It says over in Philippians that he was obedient unto the Father, even unto death. Unto death, even the death of the cross. He worshiped. What did he do? It says he went around everywhere doing good. We see him time and time again putting, and what was the Sermon on the Mount if it was not about what we might call practical Christianity? It was about how a Christian ought to live, how he ought to conduct himself in the world, how he ought to deal with his brother, with another Christian, with the world, with everybody around him. Wasn't Jesus all about practical worship? How do we serve? Remember, worship is sacrifice. It's service. How do we serve God practically? Now, there's a time and a place for us to come and to sing songs before the Lord, to preach the gospel, to hear the gospel, to testify. I don't want to downgrade any of those things. Those are necessary, and I'm glad we still do them. But that's not the end of our Christianity. There is a practical, useful work, worship for us to do outside these doors. And that's what James is talking about here. Practical worship. Remember, worship being sacrificed for the Lord. Giving unto the Lord. Service unto the Lord. Practical service. Practical worship. That's what James is talking about. So he starts off here. He says, if any man among you seem to be religious. If a man seems he does all the outward acts. And that was various for that time and that place. Again, these were Jews. They still did all the Jewish things that they did. Plus they did whatever they did when they met on the first day as followers of Christ. But they seem to be religious. He did all, if anybody has all the outward acts and they went to the synagogue and they gave and they did this and they tithed and all these other things, and he bridleth not his tongue, he deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. It's vain. Now again, we're not talking, James is not saying that he's not saved. But he says his religion, his outward acts, his worship, all the other things that he does that should be acts of worship are vain or empty. I want you to, again, go back to the prophets. Let's let the Bible translate the Bible. What did Isaiah say? What did Ezekiel say upon occasion? He said, they draw close. Isaiah said, they draw close to me. Jesus speaking through Isaiah, or I'm sorry, God speaking through Isaiah said, this people draws nigh unto me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They were doing all the outward stuff. They had a great deal of religion. He says through Ezekiel that your sacrifices stink in my nostrils. They were going through the outward acts of religion. They had a great religion. They had a great show of doing things for God. They were worshiping, but their heart wasn't in it, and God despised it. It was vain. It was empty. It wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. Now, when a man came with a right heart, with a right attitude before God, and then gave his sacrifice and gave all of those things, then it was a sweet savor unto God, wasn't it? So that's what James is talking about here. He said, if any man seems to be religious, he's doing all these other outward things that look right, but if he's not bridling his tongue, everything else that he does is in vain. Boy, that's pretty, we're not going to talk that we could go in. I'm not going to talk at length about the tongue. That's a whole sermon, at least, about the tongue. But we all know that the tongue is about the hardest thing to get under control, isn't it? Now, I'm not just talking about, you know, speaking vain words or, you know, using language, colorful language, although that's a part of it. I'm talking about what we say about other people, having loose lips, talking about things we shouldn't talk about, rumors and backbiting and talking down other people and talking down this and that and everything else. That is a wicked work of the tongue, isn't it? And that destroys. We can have all the religion, our religion in the world, and when we tear somebody down in front of somebody else, when we talk bad about somebody else, we impugn somebody's reputation or their character or whatever, that tears down everything else that we just did. So James says that one of the things that will come out of a truly changed heart is getting the tongue under control. Now that's something we all need to work better on. And he says, tells us later, essentially, that you'd be better off just to keep your mouth shut most of the time. He said, and over in Proverbs, I think it says that in much talking, there's no want of sin. Meaning, if you run your mouth long enough, you're going to slip up and sin. So you're better off just to keep your mouth shut. We probably all do better to go by that advice a little bit more. But he said, so if you see somebody that's got all the outward religion in the world, but they can't keep their mouth under control, they can't stop from spreading rumors or getting in with the juicy gossip or talking down somebody else or whatever it might be, then everything else they're doing is in vain, because until they get that under control, God's not going to be happy. That's what he's saying. That's what he's talking about. He said, if he seems to be religious, but he bridleth not a tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man is religious, is in vain. Now he's brought up the subject of religion, outward worship. What things, what life should we have? If all the rest of the life looks really good, but he hasn't got his tongue under control, that means there's some kind of underlying problem. Maybe that person is lost and undone. We don't know. Maybe that's a good indication if they can't get it under control. But that doesn't necessarily mean, I'm not talking saying, and James isn't saying that everybody that can't get their tongue under control is lost. But what he's saying is there's an underlying problem in the heart. There's an underlying issue with their relationship with God that is voiding every other outside thing that they're trying to do. It's making it of no use. And though it should be a sweet savor to the nostrils of God, it's stinking in his nostrils because there's something wrong in the heart, as evidenced by the problem with the tongue. That's what James is talking about, saying his religion is in vain. Then he goes on to talk about what pure religion is. So if we say that all these other things aren't really of themselves, all these other outward acts of worship, whatever they are, and they're different in different times, in different cultures, and whatever that they might be, whatever people would look at and say, oh, that's a really good outward act. Maybe it's, they come to church every day, they're on the this committee and that committee, and they sing, and they're in a choir, and a VBS, and all these things that a good Christian does. So that's all in vain if the tongue is not bridled. None of that in and of itself really is practical worship. It's not pure worship. James says, pure and undefiled religion, or pure and undefiled worship before the Lord is this. And he lays out these two things. But before I get into that, I want to talk about three ways. Three ways that men have devised down through the ages to try to worship. The things that they have tried to have on the outside. The types of religion, I guess you might say. Types of outward things that they do for the Lord. The first one is austerity. Austerity. And that has been popular in Christian circles down through the ages. And by that I mean that disciplining and denying the body. Disciplining and denying the body. Now, I don't disagree that there is a time and a place that we need to discipline this body. But what I mean is the what we might call the aesthetic. The person that tries to, that the outward form of their religion manifests itself in denying themselves this and that and everything else. It's manifested itself in Christianity down through the ages, sometimes in actual flogging of the body. There were those in Christian circles and monks that would, you know, flog themselves as a way of trying to get closer to God. It was not unpopular among Jews. John the Baptist, and I'm not disparaging what he did at all and not saying that God didn't tell him to do it. But what he did was something that was done wherein it says that he wore a camel hair shirt. But you know what a camel hair shirt was designed to do? It was designed to be really, really uncomfortable. It was itchy. It'd be like wearing worse than wearing like wool, old homespun wool close to your skin, right? That would itch you all the time. That's what camel hair did. That was a common thing for aesthetics in the Jewish community at that time to do, was wear camel hair as a way of humbling themselves before God. And there's a time and a place for that. And there's nothing wrong with that if the heart is right. That's not something that we're called upon necessarily to do. But that has manifested itself that way, wearing a camel hair shirt. There's been, again, religious sects in Christianity down through the ages that have done that to greater or lesser degrees. Again, flogging themselves, wearing uncomfortable clothing intentionally to try to subjugate the body. And there's nothing wrong with trying to discipline the body, but what I'm trying to get to is as a way of manifesting religion. That is a way that has been tried, but the problem is that it deals with the body, but it doesn't deal with the heart. It deals with the agency of sin. The body is what commits the sin, but not the origin of the sin, which is the heart. And so God hasn't called us to do those extreme things to discipline our body, but many forms of religion, not only in Christianity, but in many other branches of religion in general, have tried to this route of the main part of the outward working of their religion, the main part of how that their devotion to God manifested itself was in subjugating the body. And it was all self-focused. And see, you see how that's about? It's about being self-focused and disciplining the body, trying to bring the body under control through severe measures so that they can live a holy and righteous life before God. Again, the poor point of living holy and righteous before God is a good point, but the way of getting there is not the right way because it's inward focused. So being austerity or aesthetic or trying to discipline the body, denying the body, doesn't do anything for the heart. It doesn't do anything for the heart. It only does the body. So that's not a form of religion that is pure and undefiled. One of the most popular probably is ritual. Ritual. The Jews had a ritual that was given to them by God, but when the ritual overtakes the heart, the ritual becomes dead. And ritual has worked its way into Christianity, first through what became the Roman Catholic Church, and they have very elaborate rituals, as do the Eastern Orthodox churches. Many high Protestant churches, Lutherans, Episcopalians, they have very elaborate rituals. But, you know, we have our own rituals too, don't we? I mean, we have our things that we do because that's the way that the human mind works. It's easy for us. Easier than dealing with the heart is bringing our actions, forming all of our actions into a set pattern. Somebody comes up with the pattern. This is the box, the pattern that you need to lay down on your life, on the things that you do. And if you just lay that pattern down, then you form yourself to that pattern, and that is your outward devotion to God. That's your outward expression to God. And it is confined to that. And you can think again of the Roman Catholic that goes, they're very devoted to the... So how do they worship God? Well, they go, and I'm not down in Catholics, I'm just pointing out something that I know many people are kind of loosely aware of, right? You go and you go to confession to the priest. And then he gives you something to do. Maybe you do some Hail Marys. Maybe you do some Our Fathers. Whatever. You go and you do the thing, your thing before, and you pray the rosary, and you have all these different rituals that you do in order to show your devotion to God, to outwardly manifest what you say is in your heart. Men do that all the time. And it's not just in the Roman Catholic Church. It's down. And again, we have our own rituals. They're maybe more loose, but there's things that we do, right? It's just coming in and the way we set up our service. And, you know, that's a ritual. Now, I'm not saying it's bad or good, but I want us to understand that it is a ritual. And if it becomes the extent or the expression of our devotion to God, we're going to find ourselves in trouble. We're going to find ourselves in trouble as the people of God because falling into our ritual as the sole way that we worship, that we sacrifice before God, is just as bad as any more elaborate ritual. But the point is that a ritual it centers on the man and not on God or the outside. The ritual centers upon you, upon the person, conforming to this outward set of requirements. And again, that's comfortable to us. We like that. We like ritual, a box. Here, if you go fit yourself into this box, you'll be just fine. And we have to be very careful, and that's maybe one of the things that lends itself to people that were not raised as missionary Baptist coming in among us, even some that have got saved, and they just don't fit with our box, right? We got a box. Again, I'm not saying it's good or it's bad, but we have to recognize it's there. And it's a box that we created, not necessarily one that God created. And we have to understand where those boundaries are. And sometimes you'll talk about that as whether it's whether it's scriptural or whether it's tradition. You know, we got a lot of traditions. Again, some good, some bad, doesn't matter. But we have to understand where the things prescribed by God end and where our own rituals come into effect and how that might affect other people that weren't raised in those rituals. But understand it's there, and we can very easily begin to consider that as a form of worship before God, as a way of manifesting our religion to the world. Well, I go to church. I go to a missionary Baptist church, and we preach the gospel, and we have a mourner's bench, and we do this. We have Sunday school, and then we have a revival in the summer, and it's 2 weeks, and we do... Again, none of those things are bad, but that's in and of itself, those things are just a ritual. They're just a ritual until God gets involved and until our heart gets involved. And so that alone is not a manifestation of pure religion, of pure worship. finally, and this is perhaps where we'll get on ourselves, we'll critique ourselves a little bit the most. Piety. Piety as a form of outward worship. Now, no doubt God calls us to be pious. And again, that word means God-like, pious, more and more like God. But the way that that manifests itself a lot is, number one, it's not necessarily practical. It's focused inward. And it focuses a lot on emotionalism. Getting spiritually close to God. And I'll tell you, we as missionary Baptists, as old-time Baptists, if there's anywhere that we're falling down on these things about confusing what is pure and undefiled worship, it's in this. Now, there's nothing wrong with a service that becomes a spiritual service that gives us a spirit that there's emotion involved, and we cry, and people are crying, and we're shouting to the Lord. Those are good things. But that is not the extent. That's not what James says is pure. I'm just telling you what the Bible says. James did not say that that was pure religion and undefiled. That has a place, but that is not the end-all, be-all of our worship to God. Our worship to God does not stop when we come in to a revival service that tears down the house and everybody's shouting and everybody's testifying and all those things. That's good. That's good when God's in it, but that is not the extent of our worship before God. That's not the extent of what God expects from us. Number one, because that's not practical. That doesn't do anything for that world out there that wasn't in that service, does it? It mostly benefits the people that were there. And there's a time and a place for it. And if there's lost souls that are in there and they're influenced and they get saved because of it, that's a great thing. And I don't want to discount that. But I want us to see, as children of God, that is not the extent of worshiping God. That is not what James says is pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father. He didn't say pure religion and undefiled before the God and the Father is to come in and get be prayed up and have a rip-roaring, tear-down-the-barn service, as good as those are. And I don't want to discount as good as those are and the place that they have in our Christian life. But that is not the extent, that is not even the greater part, I would argue, of what it means to be a Christian. Remember, the question here, let's get back to that. What kind of life does the religion of Jesus Christ produce? What kind of life does being saved produce in an individual? And it's not the aesthetic life. It's not the life of self-denial and beating down the flesh and denying the flesh just for the sake of denying the flesh and making yourself uncomfortable. It's not performing some ritual. That's not the life that is created by salvation. And it's not even a life of piety or emotionalism, always seeking that good spiritual feeling or getting that good spiritual feeling. Because all those things are inward directed. What James is telling us is that pure religion and undefiled before the Father is outward directed. So let's get into what he is talking about. Pure. That word pure means clear. The best picture I got as I studied this is, when you take I just had a picture of, like a scientist or somebody, and you get that little vial of like pure spring water, and you're out in the daytime, and you take that thing, and you shake it up, and you hold it up to the light. To see how, is there any dirt in it? Is there anything in it? Or is it crystal clear? You know it's good when you hold it up to the light, you let the light shine through it, and it's clear. Crystal clear. That's what this word means. Pure before the Father. It's not dirty in any way. There's no fear of exposing it to the judgment of the sunlight, right? We use the sun to filter through. That's how we look. If it passes that test, it's good. He's talking about about a religion that passes the test of being held up to the light of God. If our religion, if our worship, pure or able to be held up in the light of God, able to be judged by God and be pure, and there's no fear, there's no sediment in there, there's no dirt, there's no nothing, it's crystal clear, this is what it is. That's what he's talking about. So pure, when you hear read that word here, pure, think of that, and that water held up to the sunlight that's filtering through, and there's not anything wrong with it. It is crystal clear and pure. He said, religion, pure religion that's crystal clear, able to be judged by the light of God the Father, and undefiled. Undefiled means unstained. Unstained with what? Unstained with self-seeking. A lot of religious exercise is self-seeking, isn't it, in the world? A lot of the world's religious exercise, their outward so-called worship of God, is self-serving. It's done for the benefit to show out. It's done to show other people what kind of a good Christian or what kind of a this or that that we are. It's self-motivated. We all self-motivation has to get out of our worship before God. Abraham didn't have any self-motivation. He didn't have anything that was going to benefit him when he was told to go out there and sacrifice his one and only son whom he loved, but he loved God more and he was willing to do it. And he said, I'm going to worship God. That's the kind of worship we're talking about. Totally devoid of anything that's self-serving. And so that's what James is getting at. So he says pure religion, the outward acts of Christianity, the outward life produced by a true conversion, a true heart changed by Jesus Christ, the life produced by it that's pure, that can be held up in the light of God, filtered, that can be examined by the light of this book, and it will be undefiled, unstained by any self-seeking or self-motivation, is this. He says, to visit the widows and orphans, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. There's two parts. I'll talk about those two specifics in a minute, but I want us to get the generalities to begin with. What he's talking about, these two things, there's two parts to the life of true worship before the Lord. True religion before the Lord has two parts. Love and holiness. Love and holiness. Sound familiar? Jesus said something like that in John, I believe about the 14th chapter. He said, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you. What does John talk about over in his first epistle of John the most? Let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. He said, he that loveth, that says he is saved and loves not his brother, is a liar. I paraphrased what he said there, but that's, he talked about love. Jesus talked about love. James is going back to love. He said, the true religion, true worship of God is love. I'm not talking about some kind of sentimental in your heart, oh, I just love everybody, I love this, I love that. He's talking about God-type love, agape love, charity, love that works itself out, love that has some legs on it, love that goes out and does something. That's love. That's agape love. God didn't just sit up in heaven and say, oh, I love man so much, I just love him so much, I love him, I love him, I love him. No, he did something, didn't he? It was sacrificial. He showed his love by sacrificing something for mankind. Sacrificed the most precious thing that he had, his only begotten son. That's the kind of love we're talking about. That's visit. Visit means more than just go and say, hey, how you doing? It means providing for. Now, that's not that just the widows and orphans is not the end-all be-all, but I want you to understand what they represent. In Eastern society, even today, but particularly then, the most vulnerable, the most downtrodden, and the most in need of help were the fatherless and the widows. widows. They really had nothing to live on except goodwill. They had nothing that they could offer. When you went to help a widow, there was nothing you were going to get in return because she didn't have anything to give in return. When you help, this was a time in the greater society when if parents didn't want a child for whatever reason, it was deformed, they didn't want it, they exposed the child. They would just take that child and set it out into a place and leave it to die. And if you were in need of another servant in your house, you know what you would do? You'd go out, some people would go out and rescue that child. But they didn't necessarily bring them in and treat them like their own, or like we might do with an adopted child. They'd make them a servant in their house. Oh, this child is going to be a servant because it wasn't their blood. This was a time when orphans, the fatherless, were particularly vulnerable in society. They had no rights. They had no one to stand up for them. They had no one to take care of them. And so the most vulnerable and the poorest and the least able to give you anything back in return was the widows and the orphans. He said, true love, true religion rather, is visiting them, is taking care of them. Why? Because what it shows is that you have a true love in a society that had no love, no care about widows, didn't care what happened to them, didn't care about what happened. That was the society that they lived in. He said, the true outward working of a changed heart is that you have so much love that you even love these lowest of the low, the widow and the orphan that nobody else cares about, and that you'll spend your time and your money and your effort to see to their needs, knowing that there's absolutely nothing that you'll get back in return. You won't even, in our society, you'll at least get back the accolades from men. They'll say, oh, that's so good. That's so nice that you went and did that, that you helped those. In their society, people would look like, what are you doing that for? Well, that's stupid. Why would you waste your money? Why would you waste your time? See, there wasn't even any social pressure, so you couldn't even look for the accolades of other men. And today, like I said, today, we could go out and think, well, we'll get a little bit of, people will pat us on the back if we go take care of the widows and orphans. Not in that society. They'd laugh at you. They'd laugh at you and deride you and scorn you because nobody else did it. It wasn't something that was done. It would seem foolish to do. So there was absolutely no upside for you personally to do that. That's what he's offering. That's not the extent of it, but that's why I want you to see what he's painting a picture of is love that's got legs, is actually doing something good for somebody in this life that doesn't benefit you at all. Showing the love of God to your fellow man, especially the most downtrodden, the most vulnerable, the most in need, to give of what you have for them. Because it shows love. It shows the love of God, doesn't it? He said that. And furthermore, to keep yourself unspotted from the world. To not let the misery of the world, not let the sin of the world, not let all of those things that you're going to have to get down there and rub shoulders with affect you. Now notice he doesn't put holiness first, he puts acts of love first. And as I studied this, it makes more and more sense. God wants both from us, love and holiness. But if we get love, if we get holiness trying to go first, what it'll do is a lot of times, well, I don't want to go here. That's what the Jews did. See, they got holiness, outward holiness, to the point they wouldn't even, when that Samaritan in the story that Jesus told, man was had been robbed and he was down on the side of the road, he's bleeding, he's dying. A Jew came by, and then a Levite, they crossed over and didn't even walk by him. Why? They didn't want to get defiled by him. See, they were so worried about personal holiness that they had no love left in themselves. So we don't want to get that backwards. And as a matter of fact, that love that reaches out will produce holiness. So far from staying away from the worst places in this world, we need to go out there to show compassion, show love for them. It's when we have a desire and a love in our heart to go minister to the needs of, because you're not going to find people that have real needs that need ministered to that are in the nice portion of town or anything like that. You all know that. To go out, where the homeless and the hungry are, they're right there where the drug addicts and the prostitutes and they're on. As a matter of fact, it's the drug addicts and the prostitutes that need a lot of help too. But see, a lot of times we don't want to go there because we're worried about that unholiness rubbing off on us. We don't want to be seen. We don't want to mix around that sin. But that's not what James says. He says, go out and minister to those people, and that will help keep you holy. When you're acting, when you're working for God out of pure love in your heart, it will help keep you holy. You don't stay holy by sitting at home and trying to keep all the sin outside away from you. Don't come in my door. I'm going to keep the sin out of my door. Did you go out to where it's at, where people are being afflicted by it? Because people are afflicted in this world. All that misery that we see in the world comes from what? It comes from sin, doesn't it? He said, pure religion and undefiled is this, that we show our love by going out to minister to the most needy, the most downtrodden in this world, to show the love that we have in our heart put there by God. And when we do that, we'll have a better chance of staying unspotted from the world. Love and holiness. That's what the life that should be manifested by true religion, by salvation, by a true change of heart. So that's what James is talking about here. Let us take that and think on it. Practical worship. I said worship is sacrifice. If we want to know what it looks like, how do we really worship God? I'm not saying we shouldn't come here on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. If we have Sunday night services Sunday night, we need to come to the house of the Lord. That is a facet of worship. But it's not the greater facet. I propose to you what James is suggesting is that the greatest part of our worship, the largest portion of our worship life, happens outside these doors, and it happens when we have occasion and we find occasion to express love, agape love, God-like love to other people. Wherever we find it. And that's hard. That's hard. But I said worship was sacrifice, didn't I? That's a sacrifice, isn't it? That's what God wants from us. That's pure religion and undefiled. Practical worship. Practical worship before the world is to show love everywhere we go and to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. And not to manifest sin in our own lives, to stay righteous and holy in an unrighteous and an unholy world, but yet show love, active love, agape love, sacrificial love to those that are most afflicted by sin in this world. And that can manifest itself in lots of different ways. I'm not talking about just feeding the hungry, and though that is probably part of it. But what ways can we go out there and show our love? That's what God wants. That's what James says is pure religion and undefiled. To show love to the downtrodden in society the best that we can, and to remain unspotted from the world. That's how we show. That's the acts that prove what's on the inside. Practical worship. Pure religion and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. If we do a little bit more of that type of worship, in addition to what we do here, I'm not saying we get rid of what we do here, but we need to add unto it that worship, that sacrificial worship out there of love, and keeping ourselves unspotted from the world. Brother Dyer, if we can get a song.